Welcome to The Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Georgine Rice, and it's great to be with you. This week, the church grapples with the roles of men and women.
The Bible does not take sides between man and woman. The Bible takes sides against the people who would take sides between man and woman.
A Christian school loses voucher funding due to their biblically based beliefs.
There is no place for government discrimination, specifically hostility towards religion, in American public life.
And Nikki Haley, our former ambassador to the UN, talks about her working relationship with President Donald Trump.
He was true to his word from his first day to his last day. And so he really let me do my job. And I have always been very grateful for that.
We've got all this and more. I'm Georgine Rice, your host, coming to you from my home station of KPDQ in Portland, Oregon. You can hear my program live each weekday afternoon on KPDQ FM 93.9 here in Portland and online via our website, kpdq.com, and through the TuneIn radio app. Thanks for joining us. The Bible provides the basics on how men and women should treat one another. The Creator of all knows quite well what works best. If we take our cues from society, however, things get messy and confusing, because despite what we're told by the culture and the media, men and women are not the same. Now, that doesn't mean the Christian church has always gotten this right. Author, columnist, and economist Jerry Bauer has researched this topic extensively, and he discussed the complications on the ride home with John and Kathy on Word FM in Pittsburgh.
So, Jerry, this is fraught with angst already.
Minefields.
Right. People feel very strongly about how men should act and how women should act. And so we see a conflict in culture, but also a conflict within the church.
Yeah, we do. And I think that avoiding the topics don't decrease the tension. They
right.
increase the tension.
Right.
Because the influence of the Bible is over the long run to bring peace. I mean, Jesus said, I came to bring a sword. Because as biblical ideas get introduced into a society, they run counter to the, you know, to the pagan culture. But over time, wisdom produces peace. So I would say that the church has maybe abandoned its role as a teacher in this zone, left the world to figure it out on its own. The world has defaulted to the world's mode, which is combat. And that makes this now a toxic conversation, which then Christians are afraid to have because it's a toxic conversation. But our unwillingness to have this conversation is what made it toxic in the first place. And there's no solution other than the Bible. So we better get on with it, even if it hurts a little.
Right. So the role of gender is so important to God that he essentially placed it first chapter of the Bible.
He did. And it's so important that he only says the creation is very good after you have male and female. So we have God progressively creating the world, making, you know, it's good, but okay, day one, it's good. But if it's good, why do we have day two? Well, you know, because you can make it better. And the bottom line is everything is good in the creation. The Bible says everything is good except two things. One, the creation of the firmament is not declared good. Nothing is said whether it's good or not. It's this, the firmament separates heaven and earth. And I would argue that it's not declared good because it's temporary, that there's not supposed to be a separation of heaven and earth forever. It's for now. And so it's not declared bad, but it's also not declared good. And then all the other actions of creation are declared good. And then the first time that God says something is not good, it's about Adam without having a wife, without a woman. This situation is not good. And after she's created, then after everything's done, then God says that everything's mo tov, very good. So this gender thing is not like some side thing. This is at the very heart of creation. I mean, it's not just a human thing, really. It's a thing of reality itself. Heaven is the place where the bridegroom lives, and earth is the place where the bride is. You know, heaven and earth are to some degree a representative or a kind of a foreshadowing of male and female, which is coming. God is our husband. Christ is the bridegroom. We're the bride. There's a marriage of heaven and earth. And so we see that early in creation, and then we see the creation of the woman. there's a lot going on there. Let me just say, I don't know how much people are ready for in this, right? Because we don't think biblically. We think, like, already people are starting to say, so whose side is he on?
Right.
Right?
What category can I put him in?
Right, exactly. And who is he, on the man's side or is he on the woman's side, right, in this fight? And it's like, no, like, you're completely missing it. What's declared not good? Is the man declared not good? Uh-uh. Is the woman declared not good? Uh-uh. What's not good? The separation between them. The lack of love and relationship and camaraderie between them is what's declared not good. The Bible does not take sides between man and woman. The Bible takes sides against the people who would take sides between man and woman. The Bible does not come down on the patriarch side. The Bible does not come down on the feminist side. The enemy acts by dividing the man and the woman. God says it's not good for the man and woman to be divided. That's literally the Hebrew. It's not saying it's not good for the man to be alone. It's actually divided. And the first thing the serpent comes along and does is try to divide them. When we play man off against woman, whether we're taking this allegedly conservative patriarchal view or the more liberal feminist view, whatever those things are, when we are playing them off against one another, whichever side we're taking, we're doing the enemy's work. Mm-hmm. He plays them off against one another. Mm-hmm. He manipulates them. He triangulates in modern terms. He triangulates between the man and the woman in the garden.
Mm-hmm. So recognizing that the enemy's first goal is to make an issue between man and woman should help us as we wade into whatever the conversation is, no matter what our perspective.
Yeah, we got to start out understanding gender from the Bible point of view, and we can't order our ideologies off the rack. You know, we have to, there's a tailor-made biblical view, and we got to kind of go back. You know, in the Reformation had this idea of ad fontes, back to the sources. We got to go back to the sources and recreate the biblical understanding mm-hmm. of man and woman instead of scouring the Bible looking for ammunition in a fight that is really largely a fight between two pagan views, even if one of those pagan views pretends to be Christian. Mm. Patriarchy is a pagan view. I'm not saying complementarianism is a pagan view. I'm a complementarian. But complementarian is not male chauvinist. Complementarian is there's a difference, and they have different roles, and tends to place on the man the obligation of chivalry, not the obligation of throwing the woman under the bus.
The Christmas season is upon us. In just a few short weeks, we'll celebrate the birth of Jesus. During this season, we are reminded of how far our society has fallen from the days when God was honored in both public and private sectors. As political correctness erodes religious liberty, we get difficult cases like that of legal counsel for Alliance Defending Freedom, Christiana Holcomb explained, while on the Don Crow Show on WAVA in Washington, D.C.
Now, we've talked about this with you and with others of your colleagues at ADF in the past, but for folks who don't know, what is the backstory of this particular case?
Sure. Well, the government cannot discriminate against Christian schools just because it dislikes their religious beliefs. And unfortunately, that's exactly what's happening to a small Christian school in the Baltimore area. This school, Bethel Christian Academy, had participated in the state's voucher program for a couple of years, serving low-income students, providing them with a quality faith-based education, only to then have the state of Maryland come back, trot through their student handbooks, and basically decide because of this school's religious beliefs about marriage and human sexuality, they were going to be expelled from the program. And to make matters worse, the state of Maryland is now demanding that this tiny Christian school pay back over $100,000 in vouchers that they had used to help educate students.
Now, all of these have a genesis. We know that somebody pulled the trigger on this, whether it was the ACLU or whoever. Who perpetrated this particular assault on this school? Do you know?
You know, what's so fascinating is we just received a filing from the state of Maryland that recently admitted that it was a state parent-teacher association that initially triggered the investigation. They were the ones who don't like the voucher program. They do not like providing these students with other educational options. And they were the ones that reached out to the state of Maryland and said, hey, we think they might be discriminating due to their religious convictions. So it's really kind of like the fox guarding the hen house. I mean, these are people who do not appreciate that we have educational options for low-income kids. And as a result, the small Christian school is paying the price.
Now, ADF does a lot of work in this area across the country. I'm sure this is not an isolated case. Are there other cases that have happened and and have been worked through the courts, have been adjudicated through the courts? And if so, is there a direction in which the courts are leaning in this kind of issue?
Well, unfortunately, we have seen several different cases that have gone all the way up to the United States Supreme Court where state or local governments have discriminated against or showed hostility towards religious organizations simply because of religious status or their religious beliefs about marriage. And the Supreme Court has repeatedly ruled in favor of those religious organizations, saying, look, governments must treat everyone neutrally and even-handedly. There is no place for government discrimination, specifically hostility towards religion in American public life. And so we're optimistic, and this is exactly what we've told the federal court in Maryland, and it's exactly what the U.S. Department of Justice has told the district court in Maryland, that government hostility towards religion has no place in government programs.
To what extent does the credit accrue to this administration, the Trump administration, in terms of the DOJ getting involved? Seems to me in times past, it's been quite the opposite. The Department of Justice has often gone in the other direction. I'm thinking right now of the charter schools case here in Washington, D.C. As a matter of fact, our show was a privilege to be a part of fighting for a retention of the charter school programs right here in D.C. But it was under the Obama administration that there were those who really wanted to end it after it had run out of its initial calendar life.
Well, unfortunately, you may be exactly right. We are very grateful to the current U.S. Department of Justice and their willingness to step in and say, look, government hostility towards religion has no place in public life. And frankly, this should not be a controversial prospect. This is something that should be affirmed and upheld as a fundamental principle of the United States Constitution and something defended by every Department of Justice, regardless of administration. But again, we're extremely grateful for the Trump administration's DOJ stepping in, weighing in, and lending the force of the federal government in support of this small Christian school in Baltimore.
Now, walk us through the rest of the process. How soon might this be decided? What will occur if you get a favorable ruling or not?
Well, Alliance Defending Freedom, on behalf of Bethel Christian Academy, has filed what's called a motion for preliminary injunction, asking the court to stop the state of Maryland from attempting to claw back over $100,000 from this tiny Christian school. The court recently notified us that they intend to hear oral arguments in the case, and we expect those to be scheduled for December, perhaps January. So that's kind of the next major step moving forward, and ultimately we're optimistic that the court will affirm the freedom of Christian schools to not only hold to their religious convictions, but also to participate on an equal footing with other neutral government entities to participate in these programs.
Coming up,
he was true to his word from his first day to his last day.
Former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. The Christian Outlook podcast is brought to you in partnership with Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose religious freedom is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-654-3969. That's 800-654-3969, or click on the banner ad at ChristianOutlook.com. Say what you need to say. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Georgine Rice. Few outside the South knew much about Nikki Haley when she was tapped to be the ambassador to the United Nations in the early days of the Trump administration. But she was remarkably tough when facing down anti-American nations at the UN. It soon became clear nobody pushes Nikki Haley around. And in her new book, With All Due Respect, Haley details her time in the White House. While she had her challenges with President Trump, she is not among those seeking to undermine the duly elected president. Haley discussed her time at the White House with Kevin McCullough on AM 970, The Answer, in New York City.
Let me ask you, starting with your time there, what was your impression when you were first asked? And then when you left the job, how had that changed in some way?
Well, you know, I talk about that in the book, which is really the fact that the president, when he asked me, you know, we had a conversation about it, because one of the things I said was, look, I don't want to work for someone else after being governor. I would want to work directly with you. And I said, so I want to be, you know, I would want this to be a cabinet position. And he said, done. And I said, now I'm a policy girl. And so I want to be in the room when decisions are made. so I would want to be on the National Security Council. And he said, done. And I said, well, I'm not going to be a wallflower or a talking head. I need to be able to say what I think. And he said, Nikki, that's exactly why I want you to do this. And he was true to his word from his first day to his last day. And so he really let me do my job. And I have always been very grateful for that, because when you go into the United Nations, it really did feel like I was putting on body armor every single day. You knew there was going to be a fight. You just didn't know which country you're going to be fighting. So, but it was a pleasure and honor to defend the country I love so much. And I loved every second of it.
Well, let me pick up on that in relationship to today's top headlines, because obviously impeachment is obsessing all the oxygen in the room right now. And one of the caricatures that they are playing out is that the president is some sort of control freak that sat in his, technology equipped control room and was like firing, you know, the thoughts and impulses into Giuliani and everybody that works for him. And I just come away every time I talk with someone like yourself, Ambassador, I come away with this feeling that, like, you know what? I kind of think the president empowered really talented people to go and do their jobs. And while he may have had certain degrees of wishes he'd like to see accomplished, he really trusted the people that he put in that in those positions. Is the caricature we're getting on our TV sets a little bit inaccurate, in your opinion?
I mean, you know, I can only talk about, you know, my dealings with him or when we were in the cabinet. But I can tell you he allowed everybody to do their job until they couldn't do it.
Right.
So the only people he micromanaged are the ones that he thought couldn't do their job. But he always trusted people from the very beginning to do what they thought was right. And, you know, many people always asked me how I got out without a tweet. And it was simple. It was simple that I just told him the truth. If he was doing something good, I supported, I rallied, I worked hard for him. If there was something that I disagreed with, I would call him or sit down and meet with him and say, look, I think this is a mistake. Instead, I think you should do this. And he would say, well, how do you see that playing out? And he's a great listener, and he will change his mind if you present the facts in front of him. It didn't mean that I won every time, but I always felt heard. I always saw him listen to everyone else. He would change his mind if he saw facts that represented changing his mind. And, you know, he was nothing but professional and respectful in every sense of the word in terms of working with me.
Wow, that is definitely a different picture. We're speaking with former governor and former ambassador Nikki Haley. And Ambassador, I want to talk to you next about your home state, because that, of course, is where your story kind of begins in the book. And we deal with Charleston and the flag and a whole bunch of stuff. But I want to know right now, as best as you can sense from your sources on the ground in South Carolina, how is this, I'll call it a circus in Washington, D.C., this one-sided kind of partisan activity that they're calling an impeachment inquiry? How is that playing with the Joe and Susie lunch bucket taxpayers that go to work every day in South Carolina and try as best they can to make a better world for their kids?
You know, the good people in South Carolina, they worry about the economy. They worry about jobs. They want to know that the people in D.C. are fighting for them. And so they want to know why the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement has not passed yet. You know, they want to know why our country is so divided on illegal immigration and there's no debate in Congress happening on how we're going to vet these individuals or how we're going to secure the borders. They worry about the debt and the deficit that we have and what is a great economy and want to know why it's not being talked about. They could care less about what's being said on the TV, because the people of South Carolina are smart in that they look at the facts. And I will tell you, it's been frustrating for me to see the waste of time, money, and energy that's going into the fact that, you know, do I think we should be asking foreign governments to investigate Americans? No, I don't think that. But having said that, there was no secret that the president wanted Ukraine to look and do the investigation. But never was there a threat. Never was there a you have to do this or else. The money flowed. And so there's literally nothing impeachable there.
Right.
You know, an impeachment is the harshest crime you can give an elected official. When you look at what happened, there literally was nothing there for them to even warrant this discussion on.
Well, and it's not just the harshest thing you can do to an American official. I think it's one of the most punitive things you can do to the American voter. And so I want to make sure that the grounds on which we do it, if we ever decide to, that it is highly warranted under those circumstances. Now, you've been on your book tour.
Well, I also think, Kevin, I mean, I also think that, look, we're less than a year from the election.
Right.
It's offensive not just to let the American people decide this for themselves, but I think that that's what the Democrats don't want, because they know what will happen if they decide this for themselves. And I think if you watch the hearings, there's a lot of assumption, there's a lot of perception, but we have to keep going back to the facts.
No, and I am so grateful that you said that, because that is exactly what, and there are some good people in Congress that are trying to get that story told. Lee Zeldin, one of our congressional representatives from this area, is actually one of those leading forces. But we'll see. You know, I've got a microphone. I'm not afraid to use it for the right causes. And I believe that truth is always where you find your greatest victory. We're speaking with former governor and former United States ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley. Her book is called With All Due Respect, Defending America with Grit and Grace. And Governor, I want to talk to you about your time in the UN. You said it was like putting on body armor. You had to go in there and really fight to keep America a significant voice that used its influence properly and made good decisions. And I think over the time that you were there, we saw more of that in a shorter period of time than we had. What is it about that place that is so daunting to the American servant who ends up taking that post?
Well, I think you can't be intimidated by it. You know, I mean, I think it was very important for me to let the world know what the United States was for and what we were against. And it didn't matter if they liked us. I wanted them to know where we were. And I think that it's really important that when you go in there, you go in with a strong voice. And you do that with your actions. You do it with your words. You stand up where you see something wrong, whether it's human rights violations or any sort of defiance of a UN resolution. But you also stand up for yourself. Sovereignty, like we did when we moved the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And so I wanted everyone to understand that the United States was back. We were strong. We had a voice. And we were looking for partners. But if you wanted to go against the United States, we were going to be taking names. And if you wanted to be our friend and partner, we were going to have your back.
Go to ChristianOutlook.com for the rest of that interview with Nikki Haley. Coming up, a football announcer highlights how one player was almost aborted.
This was really, really triggering to some who just could not handle hearing the reality of abortion laid bare on national television.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, where they're preparing leaders for the public square. It might be the right step for you or the recent college graduate in your life. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Georgine Rice. When someone survives a near-death experience, it's a marvelous story and people celebrate. When that person goes on to do something notable in society, the story becomes even bigger. Unless that person survived abortion. KKLA's Frank Sontag explains.
Here's a story that, for whatever reasons, and I think some of us can really think this one through, why does this news story, why did it upset so many people? A national television audience Saturday watched running back J.K. Dobbins score 4 touchdowns to help number 1 Ohio State beat Michigan, but it also learned how Dobbins' mother nearly aborted him before changing her mind. The junior rushed for 211 yards as Ohio State beat Michigan 56-27. After he scored his final touchdown, Fox Sports play-by-play announcer Gus Johnson relayed a personal story about Dobbins' mother. Quote, his mom Mia became pregnant when she was 18 years old. She went to the doctor because she was thinking about aborting the baby, but changed her mind. That baby turned out to be that young man, J.K. Dobbins, who she calls her miracle baby, end quote. It's a personal interest story. Any good broadcaster weaves in stories. Vince Scully was the best at it, our Dodger announcer, obviously. But some took issue with this particular story because it had to do with abortion. And this announcer, Gus Johnson, evidently has received a lot of pushback on this story. Now, I can share some direct quotes. It grieves me to even have to read a story like this. Like, what's the issue? How is this even something worthy of being talked about? Rivalry. Week in college football is underway. Ohio State and Michigan. While the game wasn't very competitive, something one of the TV announcers said has people up in arms. Gus Johnson apparently had the audacity to share that star running back J.K. Dobbins was almost aborted by his mother, but that she chose life. Obviously, this has allowed Dobbins to not only live, which is pretty important alone, but also grow into the successful young man he is. There's an audio clip, not really airable, it's poor quality. But it's the announcer telling the story in like 30 seconds. This commentary says, for reasons that completely escape normal people, this was really, really triggering to some who just could not handle hearing the reality of abortion laid bare on national television. One person wrote, Gus Johnson owes J.K. Dobbins and his mother an apology. How disgusting. Another, why is it necessary to discuss a mother's reproductive choices to extol the talents of a brilliant player? This is actually written by a doctor. The one responsible for this commentary says, an apology for talking about how he wasn't killed in the womb? That's a pretty weird thing to be demanding. Think of how backwards this is. That woman thinks it's disgusting to talk about not aborting someone. Maybe it should be stigmatizing if it costs someone their life. The fact that so many people were made uncomfortable by the story isn't an indictment on Johnson as much as it is an indictment on those who hold contradictory, illogical viewpoints on abortion. Here's another one. Dobbins is a talented player, but let's just let him be talented. His mother's decision was just that, hers. We can't take choice away from Ohio's women because of one feel-good story about a football player. And there's a lot more here. Last thought. For this even to be a news story, I mean, it depends on if you're a glass empty, glass full person. That it's a news story, one may say, oh, this just shows how much trouble we're in. And I would say that's true, but the glass being half full, the fact that there's so many people upset about this just shows that we're onto something and that more people need to be more courageous to state a view that the hard left or the secularists might not necessarily embrace. I mean, oh, well, we get yours rammed down our throats all the time, and we're the ones that are called intolerant. And whatever happened just to civil disagreement where we have discourse and we agree to disagree and learn from each other? Ideologically, things are getting to a place by which the one, and it's leftism, not liberals, leftism, clearly on display for all to see, those that have the eyes to see and the ears to hear. Thank you, Gus Johnson, for being a bright light.
Coming up, a look at the people from the original Christmas story.
This tells us something about the kingdom of God that is made up mostly of ordinary people.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. The Christian Outlook podcast is brought to you in partnership with Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose religious freedom is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-654-3969. That's 800-654-3969, or click on the banner ad at christianoutlook.com. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Georgine Rice. As mentioned earlier, we're just a few weeks away from Christmas morning. The season is upon us. Many homes display manger scenes. Some even have them on their lawns. But have you ever thought about the cast of characters that make up the Christmas story? Who were they and why them? Daniel Darling has thought long and hard about those individuals and details the reason each was so important in his new book, The Characters of Christmas. Darling serves as Vice President for Communications for the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. He joined me on the Georgene Rice Show on KPDQ in Portland, Oregon. Well, it is easy in our culture especially to reduce Christmas to a set of sentimentalities and experiences that oftentimes fall short of what we're encouraged to believe Christmas is all about. What drove you to encourage us to think about and to consider the people surrounding the story of Christmas that might hearken us back to the true meaning of the season?
It's great that we have these familiar rhythms and the same songs and the same story over and over again, because I think God uses that to shape our heart and draw us toward himself. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you know, every year we're wanting to find new and fresh angles at looking at the Christmas story. And I think the Christmas story is like a multifaceted diamond, really, where there's so many things about the gospel, about the incarnation that can draw us in. And this year I wanted to see what would it look like if we looked at these ordinary people whom we've kind of lionized at this point. They decorate our nativity scenes. Our kids dress up like them in our Christmas pageants. But in the first century, at the first Christmas, they were just ordinary people who were swept up in the story of God coming to earth in Jesus.
It is so interesting, the cast of characters that God chooses to play a part in this most important story in human history. And as I mentioned, and you certainly emphasize in the book, these are not the cast of characters that Hollywood would necessarily have chosen. They would quickly have overlooked them in favor of the rich and beautiful, if you will. And yet, God strategically places these ordinary people around these events, and there's something to be learned from each one of them.
You're exactly right. If you and I were writing this story, we would not have chosen the characters that are here. You think of the one chosen to be the mother of Jesus, Mary. She's a poor peasant Jewish girl. Think of Joseph, who's just an ordinary carpenter. You think of the shepherd to whom the announcement came, that they were just lowly shepherds. We would have had a press conference and a social media campaign and would have announced in Rome, or at least in Jerusalem, where the religious elite were, not in Bethlehem. And we wouldn't have chosen people from the backwater town of Nazareth. And yet this is whom God chose. This tells us something about the kingdom of God that is made up mostly of ordinary people.
Let's talk about some of those characters, beginning with the two that we are perhaps most familiar with. Joseph, who was chosen to be the earthly father of the Son of God. He's hand chosen for a task that I think most of us would shrink back from. What do you think about Joseph being chosen for that task? And what do we know about Joseph? What can we learn from him?
You know, what we know about Joseph is that he always did the next right thing. The Bible calls him righteous. And, you know, I wanted to focus on him in the first chapter because I think he's often forgotten in the story. There's maybe one or two songs written about Joseph. But here we see Joseph right away, even when he finds out that Mary is pregnant, he does the right thing by wanting to put her away privately. This would be instead of the more public way, that to shame someone who is an unwed mother. And then when the angel comes to him, he obeys and he gets up and he makes Mary his, you know, he's not afraid to make Mary his wife. He takes the child to Egypt when the angel visits him and takes Jesus to Egypt and Mary and Jesus to Egypt for their rescue from Herod. He was willing to father a child that was not his own. And think about what he was signing up for. You know, Mary got an angelic visit. Joseph got an angelic visit. But the rest of their family did. And for mm-hmm. all of their lives, there'd be a shame and a stigma attached to them. And they were willing to bear that shame. Joseph was willing to bear that shame for the one who would later bear his shame.
Mm. Well, let's talk about Mary. First of all, she's not even a legal adult by our standards today. She is a peasant girl. She probably hasn't traveled much outside of the circles that made up her everyday life. And yet God singles her out. This obscure teenager, he singles her out from among all the women on the earth that could have been chosen, or at least from the nation of Israel, that might have been chosen for that role. What can we learn from Mary, and why did God choose her?
You know, I think what we see in Mary is right from her response of, you know, first of all, why did you choose me? How can these things be? And that's the question we ask today. How can it be that Jesus could be both God and man? It's this wonderful and beautiful mystery. And yet she said yes. She said yes to God. And let's understand what she was saying yes to. Later, when she would bring Jesus to the temple for purification, Simeon would prophesy over her and say that a sword will pierce your soul. In other words,
Mary was signing up for a difficult lifetime of hardship, of shame. Probably there was a stigma surrounding her whole life. We even see later in the Gospels that many of Jesus' even own family and siblings didn't believe the Messiah narrative. And yet she was willing to do this. She would be, as a mother, she would see her son grow up. She would see him scorned. She would see him reviled. He'd be an object of derision. He'd be unjustly tried. He'd be put on a cross. She's sitting there at the foot of the cross as he's dying and bleeding, and he's mocked as the soldiers take his body off the cross and bury him. And she did all this, and she's willing to obey God because she knew and she believed that this child was the Son of God. And even though she had endured hardship for Jesus, Jesus would endure the ultimate hardship for her and paying for her sins.
Mm. Let's talk about another set of characters that there aren't many Christmas carols about, if there are any at all, and that's Zechariah and Elizabeth. Mary chooses to go visit her cousin while she is burying Jesus, and that's such an interesting part of the story of Jesus' incarnation. But talk a bit about Zechariah and Elizabeth and why that story is included in this greatest of all stories.
What's interesting about their story is the first appearance of an angel comes to Zechariah in this Christmas story. So after 400 years of silence, of no prophets, no angels, coming to a cynical people who had read the prophecies, but they're not really believing him because false messiahs had come. They're under the thumb of Roman rule. Here's Zechariah with a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to light to give the incense in the temple. And Gabriel appears to him and says, your prayers have been answered. Your prayers for a son, your prayers for a Messiah. And what we can learn from Zechariah and Elizabeth, I think, is a couple of things. I think, number one, they were well past childbearing age, and yet God birthed in them a son, John the Baptist, who'd be the final prophet, who would be a forerunner of Jesus. And God had to silence Zechariah because of his unbelief. And I think what we learned from them is sometimes God has to put us in a period of silence and waiting for us to see him work. But we also see this theme of rebirth and recreation that you see throughout the Bible. Abraham and Sarah could not have children. Hannah could not have children. Zechariah and Elizabeth. And yet God birthed something new out of what was dead. And this is something that God wants to do in each of us. He wants to birth this new spiritual birth in each of us.
Coming up, the troubling story of Chick-fil-A.
People like you and me feel betrayed.
Franklin Graham, when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. Chick-fil-A has been under attack by the far left for years for the faith of its founder, Truett Cathy. And when his son, Dan Cathy, noted he believed in a biblical definition of marriage, political activists within the LGBTQ community went into perpetual protest mode. Well, the protest fizzled as Christians flocked to the stores and made it the biggest selling day in Chick-fil-A history. And that's been the story of this highly successful franchise. They get heat from the far left, but tremendous support from the millions of Christians. Then it was revealed that Chick-fil-A acquiesced to the far left and stopped funding wonderful organizations like the Salvation Army and the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, groups that have also caught heat for their biblical view on marriage and human sexuality. People waited for a response from Chick-fil-A, but none came. Shortly after the news broke, syndicated host Eric Metaxas discussed the topic with Franklin Graham.
What Chick-fil-A did, it was like France surrendering to Hitler. Tons of people just were heartbroken, stunned. What do you think is happening?
I'm not sure Dan Cathy understands that the support for Chick-fil-A comes from middle-class Americans who love his restaurants. They're clean. They have a good sandwich. They're kid-friendly. The gay and lesbian movement is not their supporters. They're not the ones that are coming through their lines. But now Dan Cathy, Chick-fil-A will serve anybody who comes through. It doesn't matter what your race is, your sexual preference is. They're going to serve you as the same as anybody else. They just do a fantastic job of providing a good meal. But you have to understand Chick-fil-A is in the crosshairs of the gay lesbian movement because they gave their own personal money to organizations that support marriage the way we would view marriage biblically. And so the gay lesbian movement has come after them. And I would say to Chick-fil-A, stand your ground. The people that are buying your sandwiches are going to keep buying them.
Yeah. This is to me a public relations disaster. And I think that people feel betrayed. And I think that unless
they reverse course, they are going to be very dramatically affected. I have no doubt of it.
I think it's going to hurt them, and I hope they do reverse course. The gay lesbian movement is not going to be happy till Chick-fil-A starts donating to them and flying the rainbow flag at their stores. I think that's they're going to keep that pressure on until that happens.
That's the way it is. But Chick-fil-A have been just one of the very few heroes to just say, no, yeah. We're not going to accept your definition of hate. We're not going to accept what you say about who we are or how we fit. We're just going to keep doing what we do. And most Americans at this point just cheer and will That's drive right. miles out of their way to go to a Chick-fil-A because of that.
I
and
do.
So for them to reverse course, it's just staggering. I just wonder if they would possibly reverse course. I think if they don't, they're going to be very, very sorry. It's going to be dramatically different for them.
I just really need to pray for Dan, Kathy, and Bubba that they'll do the right thing.
To hear the rest of that conversation, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That wraps up this edition of the Christian Outlook. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play, and never miss these and other great conversations. Start at ChristianOutlook.com. Thanks for joining us today, and thanks again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards and David Posehn and Mike Cook, I'm Georgine Rice. Join us again next time for the Christian Outlook.